If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Team Human is an ad-free, listener-supported project made possible by teammates like Sean Wilson, T.O., Duncan Slobodzian, Josh, Zach McKinney, Bjarne Panduro Zvekov, Nathan H., and hopefully you. Just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support to find the others who gain access to our Discord channel, my paywalled Medium posts, archives of my writing and conversations, and participation in our live Team Human salons in the Kibitz Room. See you there. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an effort to recognize the value we create instead of surrendering it to the engines of extraction, a chance to retrieve the commons, our creative capacity, and our communities of exchange. It's time to stop optimizing human activity for the market and to start optimizing the market for human beings. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, science fiction author, journalist, and my smartest friend, Cory Doctorow.
Sometimes you'll get as far as you can go, and you'll go, well, this is it, right? I can't, I'm out of steps. It doesn't mean that there are no more steps to take. It just might mean that you're going to have to start all over again.
Cory will be sharing his latest thoughts on the many ways our economy and creativity are being hacked by the perpetrators of choke point capitalism. It's time to intervene on our own behalf. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. Lordy Linda, Elon Musk has accomplished a lot in the past week or so. And no, I'm not talking about the new Twitter owner's implementation of the $8 for a blue checkmark scheme or his massive reduction in workforce before rehiring many of them the next day. Or his proposal for a content moderation council to judge and delete dangerous tweets. Now, I'm more interested in how, really by his own example, he revealed his impotence, as well as that of the social media star he replaced, Donald Trump. And in doing so, Musk has also revealed the inadequacy of any dictatorial approach to technology, business, or politics. It's as if the air has changed. I don't know if it's just him, but something's changed. So let's just go through what he did fast, just like he did. Right from the get-go, his decision-making process has been imperious and whimsical, lacking any coherent strategy or awareness of second and third order effects, oblivious to the way choices externalize harm to others. And as performative as a businessman on reality TV. He played to the most sycophantic entourage of hangers-on, all of them trying to win the attention of their cult leader. And then he came out of the gate, literally hours into the first morning as chief, spreading fake news and defying all social norms. And no, I'm not talking about Trump, but his replacement at the top of the Twitter troll poll, Elon Musk. And I think the only way to understand him is as the third in a succession of increasingly powerful social media anti-heroes who melted down in front of millions of people. Right? The first was Charlie Sheen, who shortly after getting fired from his sitcom, he proceeded to go on this manic posting streak. Remember, it was like tiger blood and winning. And they may not have been potent memes, but Sheen, he had jumped into what we could call the standing wave of social media culture. The Sheen thing, it all occurred immediately after Iran's kind of failed Twitter revolution, when it seemed like the entire platform had become super serious as we collectively witnessed a nation attempting to wrest itself from authoritarian control. And after that, we kind of needed comic relief. And Sheen, he just jumped into the Twitterverse like a surfer into the ocean and was carried along by this wave of attention populated less by true fans than voyeurs hoping to watch the inevitable crash. And Donald Trump, he was the next to take the leap in there. He wasn't really a leader with policies so much as a salesman capable of reading the emotional and entertainment needs of his audience. And he rose to fame by taking down critics like Rosie O'Donnell or posting unattractive pictures of other candidates' wives. His power, you know, such as it was, it derived from his ability to tweet orders to the crowd, you know, turn on Trump and he will turn his followers on you. And many people feared that the worst thing Musk might do, like taking the helm at Twitter, would be to restore the former president's posting privileges. But instead of restoring Trump, I feel like Musk replaced Trump as tweeter in chief. Yes, Musk is to Trump as Trump is to Sheen. And just like his predecessors, Musk is less concerned with his impact than how it plays with the crowd. He just wants attention. Maybe he wants to show he can become the true techno-monarch called for in his partner Peter Thiel's political philosophy. But if the last few days were any indication, he also revealed why he could never be entrusted with such power. For just as Trump would threaten his adversaries with the wrath of his Twitter following, Musk is now doing the same to his advertisers. Many brands paused their spending on the platform, you know, for a week or so for fear of how the platform was changing. But as Musk saw it, this is a quote, "Twitter has had a massive drop in revenue due to activist groups pressuring advertisers, even though nothing has changed with content moderation, and we did everything we could to appease the activist. Extremely messed up. They're trying to destroy free speech in America." So Musk's response to this was to threaten them with what he said was thermonuclear name and shame if this continues. In other words, he's going to use Trump's mob blackmail techniques in business instead of just politics. Advertise on my platform or my army of trolls will mimetically annihilate you. What an elucidating preview of how a techno-monarchy might work. Not to mention what a winning inducement for new brands to join the platform and face similar offers they can't refuse. But the net effect of Musk's activities, it was mostly bad for Trump, bad for tech titans, and good for democracy. Musk upstaged Trump just when the former president was looking for some attention. He says he's running again. Did anybody catch that? And he was trying to influence the midterms. Musk certainly distracted media coverage from Trump's escapades at a pivotal moment. Was it enough to sway the election? I don't know if we'll ever know, but I kind of think it was. More importantly, by enacting what we could call Tiger Blood 3.0, Elon Musk has exposed not only the problem with running a social media network from the top, but also the dangers inherent in giving a social media star so much authority over our world. Luckily, we are all finally getting the message. Oh, and you can find me from now on Mastodon at rushkoff@social.coop. Check it out. I think we may be on the verge of having good, useful fun again. Something has shifted. Feel it.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's a rare treat these days to see old friends somewhere other than a Zoom window. So it's a particular pleasure to share this conversation that Corey and I had in my hotel room a couple of weeks ago when we were both there for the Ottawa Writers Festival. I met Corey Doctorow, gosh, maybe 20 years ago at Boing Boing founder Mark Frauenfelder's house in LA. I remember Mark whispering to me, "I've got a young guy from Canada staying with me. He's smarter than us and knows how things actually work, but he's fun." That's still about the best description I can think of. Corey has written a bunch of great science fiction books, Little Brother, Homeland, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, as well as the new book with Rebecca Giblin, Choke Point Capitalism. Corey is great at staring into the abyss of techno-capitalism, seeing the darkness at its core, and then emerging with hopeful, actionable steps to pull ourselves back from the brink. I wanted to talk to you about Taylor Swift.
Uh-huh.
Because she came out with her new thing, new albums, like last night and the day before, or 2 days ago at midnight and at 3 a.m. And they broke all the records on all the things and sold all this stuff. And she had a major fight to get back ownership of some of her music. And then what I read in Choke Point Capitalism, I had never known that she fought on all of our behalf.
Well, on the behalf of all recording artists, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did this thing where Universal was trying to woo her. And Universal, like the other big three labels, had gotten this giant windfall because they wouldn't let Spotify launch without giving them a giant equity stake. So they owned a big chunk of Spotify. And when Spotify IPO'd, because Universal, Warner, and Sony, the big three labels, had all agreed to take less money from their artists for their artists from Spotify to make Spotify look more profitable, they got a huge return on those shares because Spotify looked like a very profitable company to investors. It made a lot of money. So they got billions of dollars, which were theirs to use as they saw fit. And they all made some noises about returning some of that money to creators. But there's a shell game that they get to play, which is that almost everybody who has a record deal owes their record label money. You start off owing your record label money, not just your advance, but also all the expenses associated with your advance. Like they bill you for the champagne at the launch party that they put on and plan.
Right.
From the supplier that they buy the champagne from, an enormous markup. And you get whatever it is, depending on what kind of act you are. It might be a 5% royalty, it might be a 15 or 20% royalty, but you get this royalty on your music, which means that the $150,000 that it nominally costs to produce your record will still have an outstanding balance even after you've made millions of dollars for the record label. And so one of the shell games that the labels had proposed to play was that they were going to, quote, give some money to artists, but all they were going to do is apply it to their outstanding balances.
Right.
So no money would actually go to the artist. And Swift said, I will only go to Universal if the share is given off the top. You just have to write people checks.
And not just to herself, using her power as Taylor
Everyone
Swift.
In Universal.
Everybody.
Yeah, the largest label there is, which is great.
And she was worth it to them to do it.
And having Swift have solidarity, class solidarity, is amazing. And we thank her for it. It's not a substitute for actual like structural change, right? It's like, it is amazing that she did what she did. But all that tells us is that the fact that it's like one person made an arbitrary choice tells us that this is not a fair system.
Yeah, but then doesn't that mean then, I mean, yes, it's not a fair system, but then if those who make it to there, if Stephen King does that with authors and Spielberg does it with filmmakers.
Yep.
And,
yeah, I mean, Stephen King did it when he went and testified against the Simon & Schuster merger. It's the threat.
James Gandolfini did it when he was, the Sopranos guy.
Yep.
And people were saying, oh, you make so much money. And he's like, no, I'm doing this for everyone. That's right.
And as the same thing happened when the Hollywood writers, all 7,000 members of the Writers Guild, went on strike against their agents,
right,
including the ones who their agents liked and were doing good by. It is often the case in these arrangements where you have like an intermediary, like a publisher or a studio or a label, and then you have talent that either through bargaining leverage or because of sort of cynical planning, one person does really well or a small number of people do really well. In the same way that like if you go to a Midway, by 10 a.m., there's someone with a giant teddy bear who's won it at one of the ring toss games.
Uh-huh.
And that person walks around all day carrying the teddy bear and lots of people go and play the Midway. Right? James Gandolfini and Taylor Swift and so on. One of the reasons the labels are okay with them having as much money as they do, because the label's first preference is to not give anyone any money except for their shareholders and their executives. One of the reasons labels and studios and publishers are okay with there being these winners is that they're the people lugging around the giant teddy bears that lure in the rest of the workforce at substandard wages. And, you know, the difference between that and paying everyone a living wage represents a significant savings. Even with these like headline figures for the A-list artists, there's a significant savings. And it's always short-lived, right? It only lasts until the intermediary no longer has to lure people in. So you see this with Twitch, which Amazon bought in 2014. And Twitch, their nominal deal is a 50-50 split, which means that they take half the money you make as a Twitch streamer, which is a lot.
Yeah.
But they secretly had a deal where their A-listers got 70%. And they announced recently in a kind of hair-pulling way, they said, you know, we have to come clean. We've secretly had this arrangement where our A-listers are getting 70%. That is so unfair. We're going to pay them 50%. And they had the best reason for it, which was our bandwidth costs too much. Now, they buy their bandwidth from Amazon. And Amazon is the company that owns them.
Right. So they can mark up the bandwidth to whatever they wanted to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, Amazon says that Amazon charges Amazon so much to be Amazon that Amazon can't afford to pay its streamers.
Isn't it? I guess the thing I wanted to talk with you about is the way that we as tech thinker, science fiction writer people ended up, at least me, I ended up getting dragged, kicking and screaming into these arguments about business and economics. This is not what I particularly cared about. It wasn't my expertise. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went back for the PhD in this stuff after AOL, Time Warner merger, after the dot-com crash, after social media, after all these elements, strategies of choke point capitalism took hold. And maybe we're slightly good at it because with a programmer's sensibility, we could look at economics a little bit more neutrally, you know, a little bit like it's what is this optimized for?
Right. So I would say that I always had some interest in economics because I've always been interested in labor issues and political issues and so on. What I didn't know much about until much more recently was finance. And finance isn't economics, right? Finance is a bunch of like procedures.
Right.
And finance was not core to early tech companies, in part because early tech companies had such a favorable cost basis, right? Software is cheap to make. And with the internet, you can kind of multiply the effect of a single creator or a single software author or a small team, and they can support lots and lots of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of you think about like products like Basecamp or, you know, Slack, where you had a small team that were supporting lots and lots of users.
All you needed was the angel round. Yeah. That was basically it.
Yeah. Or you could self-finance or, you know, if you remember like the shareware days, if you remember just these very exciting moments in technology. Yeah. Hardware has a lot of CapEx, capital expenditure. But even then you had people who were, you know, had this like slow ramp up where they would build things by hand, and then they would start a small factory, and then they would outsource a little bit, and so on. It wasn't financialized, right? Like the major success factor of a tech company wasn't its ability to maintain the fiction that its headquarters was in Ireland, and so it didn't owe any tax to anyone, right? It was about much more about whether the technology was good. And what's happened is that, as with every other sector, finance has become the central organizing principle. So you mentioned Time Warner. You know, the Time Warner AOL merger was a big deal. The Time Warner Discovery merger, much more recent one, which resulted in Time Warner looking at the tax code and their balance sheet and deciding that a bunch of shows were worth more dead than alive and canceling shows that had audiences that were making money because the tax break for the write-off was bigger than the expected return for the ongoing production.
It's why they're empty. It's the same reason there are empty storefronts in my town of Hastings-on-Hudson, because the landlords get more on writing off a $5,000 a month expense than they would get for the $2,000 a month rent they could actually get for the place. Yeah,
so this is financial optimization. And I think that the programmer mindset for finance is ugly, right? That when you bring people who view rule systems as something to be explored and hacked, that you get just stuff like, you know, there's this viral story going around now that ProPublica published about an algorithm that raises your rent. Right? Did you see this?
And I think so.
It's got all this real-time telemetry. It's doing a bunch of like very illegal things where it's gathering data from multiple landlords and allowing them to tacitly collude to raise rents, which is an antitrust violation, like a per se antitrust violation. Totally illegal. But mostly what they've done is they've just sort of figured out exactly like a kind of algorithm for when you keep the apartment empty, when you let a good tenant who's never been late on their rent go because you raise the rent beyond what they, you know, they can pay, in the expectation based on your telemetry about other units and what they're clearing for, that a tenant who will pay more will show up. So it's not like this tenant ever failed to pay you exactly what you asked for. And it's not like this tenant has ever been anything but a great tenant. And nevertheless, the algorithm kicks them out. And the programmer who ran the project gave a great money quote, literally and figuratively, to ProPublica. He said, it's better to use the algorithm because people are too sentimental and they don't want to hurt the tenants. Right. Mm. And that the algorithm is just, it doesn't have a heart.
Right. It helps you be inhumane.
Yeah. And so, yeah, programmer mindset. I mean, I don't know that it's just programmer mindset. Right. I think finance has had this mindset for a very long time. But
yeah, which is basically, how do we either defeat or exploit what we're learning in behavioral economics? Oh, these people are being too sympathetic with each other. How do we stop that? Or these people, they have a bias towards seeing money in the distance, you know, as smaller. So we'll
sure. But also, like, how do we do regulatory arbitrage? Like, you know, cryptocurrency is just basically a bunch of things structured to fill into lacuna in finance regulation, right? It's not really, like, anytime you hear fintech, you should just think unregulated bank. That's what fintech really amounts to. So it's not like they invented something new. They just figured out a way to do something that used to be illegal.
Well, by using something that may have been built for a different purpose.
Yeah, although I would argue that Bitcoin and its associated technologies, blockchain technologies, were primarily built for that. I know that there are lots of people who make claims that there are non-financial applications for blockchain. I've yet to meet a credible one, and that is not an invitation for people listening to this to email me and explain to me your theory.
Well, because like me, you get those emails every day.
Yeah.
But I've engaged with the, I hate to call them this, but with the young people involved.
Yep.
Their intentions are good.
Many of them, that's true. Yep. And, you know, you're right. And this is why I continue to engage in the subject, not to the point of having yet another conversation about why your blockchain is good. But when I listen to the rhetoric of the people who I think are honest dealers in the cryptocurrency blockchain world, I hear echoes of the things that matter to me. I also hear lots of people who are saying things that I'm very antithetical to. And so I think there's a mix there. But for the people who are of goodwill, I have time and, you know, I have already done multiple long form articles and multiple hour long podcasts in which I explain it. And it's just not, there's no productive use of your or my time for you to call me up and for you and me to rehash a conversation I've already had.
Right.
You know?
Right. I guess. And that's, you know, I feel that way about so many things, but then the things persist. I mean, sure. I thought I could put down the dot-com boom after Wired magazine did its long boom cover. I wrote the piece. I explained what was wrong. Right. Yet the industry kept going.
It's true. Well, and, you know, there is, I forget whose law it is, but there's someone's
one
law.
One of those Godwin kind of people.
Anything
I guess.
That can't go on forever will eventually stop.
Oh, good.
Right? And I mean, how it stops is something else. I just had lunch with a very dear old friend who's working on environmental activism in Quebec. And we were talking about just how chaotic and awful it is. And we were talking about Thomas Piketty and his theory that the 30 glorious years in the, you know, from the 40s to the 70s, when we saw a much more pluralistic distribution of wealth and enormous amount of growth and innovation and much more fairness and just a better place to be, you know, the birth of all of these social safety nets, that what changed was that the share of wealth owned by the top decile had been mounting steadily since the destruction of the world wars. And it reached a tipping point where once again, they could command policy outcomes. And when rich people can command policy outcomes, it's destabilizing because they say, let's grow ornamental flowers for my gardens rather than the food that you need to eat. And eventually that reaches a tipping point. You get another orgy of destruction, you know, the French Revolution, the World Wars, and so on. And then, you know, out of the rubble where you have a much more pluralistic distribution, because like if 99% of the wealth is owned by 1% of the people, and then you destroy 90% of the wealth, most of it's going to come out of the 99% share. Just because there's no one else for it to come out of. And so then you get these better policies again. And my fear is that the thing that can't go on forever right now is environmental degradation. And the way that it stops is not with a reset to a fairer distribution, but with something much more like civilizational collapse.
Right. And I'm looking at that civilizational collapse too. And I mean, one of my main concerns is how many intelligent people in my orbit seem to want to accelerate things toward that end. Hmm. You know, whether it's the there's a kind of a Marxist accelerationist, you know, the sort of Zizek, like, well, it's going to be like Trump, it'll just bring the end faster and we'll get this kidney stone out of our system. Or the sort of the new right adjacent philosophical sense-making crowd who are trying to get us to the stranger tractor at the end of time or reach, you know, Deschardins omega point, and then we rise from the chrysalis of matter or we get to that next fractal emergent state.
Are you talking about long-termism?
Long-termism, but them and the sort of that, they're not really banded anymore, but a lot of what I used to hear on the Rebel Wisdom podcast from these guys talking about is sort of a post-Burning Man ayahuasca, where they go with it.
Yeah, it's kind of mystical eschatology.
Right. And, you know, and it has shades of Bannon and his Eastern mysticism.
So look, I think there's different things going on all at once that are probably feeding off of each other.
Right.
One is, I think that the way to understand the philosophical origins of the singularity, which at its core is this idea that eventually technology will become so complicated that no one can understand it, is that its adherents tend to be people who once felt like they were really on top of things, and then the world moved past them, and they find it much more convenient to think that things are literally incomprehensible rather than that they are just no longer able to understand things.
Right.
Right. Once, après moi le deluge, right? Once I don't understand how Wi-Fi works, no one can understand how right. Wi-Fi works.
It is incomprehensible. Yeah, it is too complex.
This is just nonsense. And, you know, I feel that way. As a guy who you know, memorized the AT command set in the 1980s right. and was really, really interested in the differences between 802.11a and 802.11b, yeah. I see, like, 802.Wi-Fi 6e, and I try to read the spec, and I'm like, this is too complicated. You know, not too complicated to use, but yeah. like I'm just going to press the right. Wi-Fi 6E button and I'm not going to hold like an opinion, like a technical right. opinion. This is just too complicated. And it's not really too complicated. It's just that, like, you know, in the same way that when conservatives say things used to be simpler and now they're all too complicated, what they really mean is I used to be a child and my parents used to shield me from complexity. You know, the reason that I was able to master the AT command set when my computer scientist father, who brought home the Hayes modem that I mastered the AT command set for, couldn't, is my dad had a job, right? I was a 10-year-old.
Right.
I had nothing else to do. I memorized the AT command set. My dad was busy,
yeah.
right? And like the reason I don't understand Wi-Fi 6E is I've got a job.
Right.
You know?
Right. You have people to take care of.
Yeah.
Well, and also, I mean... But yeah, I have a hi-fi brain. You mm-hmm. know, I know how stereos work.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Yeah.
And that was hard at the time.
Yeah. At one point you had some important technical knowledge. And like I don't believe that it's harder to gain. Anyway, so that's the first yeah. half of it, right? You have this après moi le deluge. The singularity is anything I can't understand, because if I can understand it, no one can understand
right.
it. It's literally beyond human comprehension. And I think the other thing is capitalist realism. It's just this idea that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism.
Right.
You know, this inevitabilism, right? That I think things like Stan Robinson's Ministry for the Future are important because they plot a course from A to Z.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that it's tempting to look at that as a game plan. It's definitely not a game plan. What it is it's a plausible feeling way to get to the end of capitalism without getting to the end of the world. And once you admit the possibility that there's one plausible way, you admit the possibility that there might be more, right? But for so long as it is implausible to imagine that we could do anything better, right? So long as Manchin and Sinema are in the Senate, we can't have nice things, you know, and we shouldn't even try, right? Because to try... You know, to run an FDR strategy and to have Biden go to Arizona and campaign against them directly to their voters, go to West Virginia and campaign against them directly to their voters, that is, you know, beyond the pale. It would cause us to lose power. And if we lost power, we wouldn't be able to make the changes that we still can't make because of Manchin and Sinema.
Right.
But think of how bad it would be if the other party gets in, which they're going to do because we didn't make any changes. You know, like we just get trapped in this kind of morass of capitalist realism. And so when you combine this idea that the world is now too complicated for anyone to comprehend, and also that there's no way that we could change it, then what do you have left except for eschatology?
Right. Right. And the whole problem with eschatology for me is not even, I mean, I could get stoned and listen to Terence McKenna, you know, which is the appropriate place for it, right?
Right.
For imagine we can rise from the chrysalis of matter as pure consciousness and live as a fractal being. And it's great. It's beautiful. It's fun.
Sure.
Yay. It's a little masturbatory, but whatever. It's all good.
I love going to Burning Man.
Yeah,
I went
exactly.
this year.
God bless. But it's not a theory of change.
No. It's
a description of an end state, but it's not the how we get from here to there. How do we adopt a comportment that is more caring for our fellows.
Yeah. I just read Anand's new book, The Persuaders,
mm-hmm.
and he evinces or quotes a theory of messaging that says you should start with an appeal to shared values,
right?
Then identify a problem, then identify
right.
a villain.
Yeah, he right? discovered deep canvassing is
yeah,
what it's called.
Well,
yeah.
he talks about deep canvassing, yeah. and this is slightly separate from that.
Yeah.
This is, I've forgotten her name. She's in Oakland, and she you know, does alternative messaging for the mm-hmm. Democrats. She's sort of like, this is what you said, this is what you could have said. And shared values, they are important. And the people who I go, who are at Burning Man with me, we have some shared values. Some of them I have a lot of shared values with, mm-hmm. but all of them I have some shared values with, because it's a very weird thing to do, sort of objectively.
Yeah.
You know, even though 100,000 people do it, it's still a drop in the bucket. It's not for everybody. And whatever it is that makes that good to you is something that's good to those other people. I feel the same way about science fiction and about, you know, other subcultures that I belong to that aren't explicitly political. There's some shared value there. Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to watch Dungeons and Dragons' political valence shift because D&D grew out of wargaming.
Right.
And it was super right wing. When I was a kid going to Dungeons and Dragons in Toronto, wearing my anti-nuclear proliferation buttons, everybody else would come up to me and go like, I think we should nuke them till they glow, right? Most of them were military or ex-military, or they were cadets or they were reserves. They were all hawks. They were all cold warriors.
Right.
They were all rabid anti-communists.
Right. And then there were the Ayn Rand ones. Remember that?
Oh, those two. But today,
yeah,
within gaming, there is a huge movement of leftists.
Right.
Right? There's a huge movement of people who are like, when I sat down with those people who were very different from me and played an orc or a goblin or an elf or a whatever, leaving and didn't think about the racial undertones of there being an evil race and a good race, mm-hmm, I nevertheless experienced something profound in the imaginative exercise. And today, I want to figure out how to make a version of that that isn't racist. I want to figure out how to, I mean, it was a couple of years ago, I blogged this person who had done an entire set of rules, character sheets, and STL files to print out your own miniatures of battle wheelchairs, right? And just like, disability representation within games. And like, it is historic, right? Like we know, I mean, Dungeons and Dragons is not historic, but we do know that we see the remains of people who would have required assistive technology and assistance from the people around them who grew to adulthood and who were cared for. Like those people were among the people who lived and were part of those communities. Right. It's not like if you lost a leg, they exposed you on a rock or something.
Exactly. They tell us about the Eek people when we're in middle school as if, oh, before civilization, if you had anything wrong with you, they'd leave you on a cliff to be eaten by wolves.
By vultures.
Yeah. And it's like, no, actually, they took care of everybody.
We all took care of each other. Or rather, we've had the full spectrum of societies all along, which I think is the rise of everything. Yeah. Or dawn of everything. That's the motif of that like all the arrangements are possible, none of them are inevitable. Capitalist realism is a zap on your mind, right? It's there to make you not look for anything else. It's one of the things that makes science fiction exciting, because if Margaret Thatcher's motto is there is no alternative, science fiction's whole raison d'etre is let's think of some alternatives.
Right
Margaret Thatcher disguised a demand as an observation. There is no alternative doesn't mean there is no alternative, it means stop trying to think of one. Right. And science fiction's job is to never stop trying to think of one.
Right. Which is, for me, the best function of it. It forces people to suppose. Just the act of supposing then creates new possibilities. Even if the ones in the story itself are wrong, the exercise of speculation is.
Yeah. And so back to shared values. Right. I think that when I think back on those people that I gamed with in the 80s as a teenager and as a tween, they and I had very different politics, but we had some shared values. Like it was a minority fringe thing to pretend to be a magical creature, right? That's just not a thing that normal people did then. And it gave us some common ground. And it's the starting place for a conversation. And, you know, one of the things about The Persuaders that is so good is that it talks about the slow, long run process by which people change their minds. And it doesn't go to these kind of simplistic accounts where like Google invented a mind control ray to sell your nephew fidget spinners and then Robert Mercer stole it and made your uncle a QAnon. Mm. Right. Instead it says like if your uncle is a QAnon, he was probably racist all along, as many people of your uncle's generation may have been. It wasn't as important to him until other things happened, until he lost faith in institutions. The faith that he lost in those institutions created a void in which other values or other ways of understanding his own views could be kind of inserted. And that void was filled by the likes of Steve Bannon, but he didn't create the void. Right. He didn't create the susceptibility.
Right. Do you think the object of the game is to, you know, rebuild those institutions or rebuild our faith in those institutions, or to somehow carry forward the sort of the social agreements that those institutions held and try to infuse them differently.
In a technologically complex society, you need institutions, because to get through your day without making a fatal error, like a literally fatal error, you would need, if without an institution's support, you would need 25 PhDs, right? Like, are the food hygiene standards for your breakfast adequate, or will you be dead by lunchtime? Is your kid going to be an ignoramus for going to Zoom school? Should that 737 Max that you're getting on this afternoon, should you trust it? Is the anti-lock braking software for your car adequate? Is the reinforced steel joist that's holding up the ceiling over our head, was the specification for that alloy adequate or inadequate? How are we to live through the day? The only way you can do that is to have some process whereby people who have different views, sometimes those differences are parochial. I have a patent on this and I think everybody should use it. Sometimes they're in good faith. I have a sincere belief that this is how it should be done. And those different views have to be aired in front of referees who are themselves disinterested and yet expert, who then arrive at a decision. That decision takes on the force of law or regulation. Its workings are understood. It's carried out in public. There's a means by which you can reopen the discussion. And even if you don't know what's going on inside this box where the deliberation takes place, you can look at the box and tell whether it's square and has good corners, right? You can say, this looks like an honest process. And there was an amazing thing where John Oliver, during the Obama years, said, Tom Wheeler is going to destroy net neutrality. He is a dingo babysitter because he used to be a Comcast lobbyist. Fly my pretties and crash the FCC's website. Tom Wheeler turned out to be committed to net neutrality, not to dismantling it. But his successor was a Verizon lawyer.
Right.
Ajit Pai wanted to dismantle it. And you can understand why, a priori, John Oliver didn't trust the FCC, because it was being led by a lobbyist from its covered industry. The fact that he happened to have our back as the American people is like Taylor Swift happening to have our back as performers. It's not something we can rely on. Like, it's not a substitute for a good system. We can all look at the system and say it's rotten. And so if it's rotten, you can't trust it.
Right. We can't depend on benevolent individuals within the system.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there are all of these stories. In fact, I'm writing a short story now for a project about this. There are all these stories about people who got the order to push the nuclear button and didn't push the button. Right? A Soviet subcommander, an American. There have been lots of instances in which we were on the brink of nuclear war and someone gave the order and someone else said, usually the way that they put it in the aftermath is they say, I thought the call was wrong. I understood the underlying alert system and I thought that it was a false positive. But reading between the lines, it feels like what they're saying is, even if it were true, I couldn't bring myself to exterminate the human race.
Right.
Something I kind of
hope
is true.
But in these cases, were they all mistakes?
Yeah, they were all mistakes. All right. Well, I mean, obviously, right? Because there wasn't another strike inbound, right?
There
was always a mistake. So that's great, right? It is really heartening to know that every time someone got the order to push the button, they said no. It would be better if we got rid of the buttons,
right?
I don't want to take that chance, right? Like, I just don't want there to be.
Especially as we know now, certain branches of the U.S. Armed Forces are becoming, you know, radicalized. You know, there's a huge swath or and nothing against fundamentalists, but there's a intentional population in the Air Force now.
Entryism.
Yeah,
for sure. There's definitely a big whack of that. But, you know,
because then it can lead to people doing actions for reasons that kind of do go against their own.
And also, I just think that there's just a certain degree of, allopathic risk, which is like, you know, even if we only ever give people access to the button if they're good people who really understand things and so on, just, you know, if it's a 1 in a billion chance that one of them is going to push the button by accident. Or,
eventually.
You know, eventually we'll have a billion circumstances, right? If we can eliminate a one in a billion chance of the end of civilization and the end of our planet is habitable by
it's just like having a bottle of poison in the kitchen cabinet. It's like, yes, it's labeled poison.
Right.
We know not to take it at night. Someone sleep. It's like, why is it in the kitchen?
Right, right. Right. Yes, exactly. Let's put that under lock and key. Let's get rid of it. Do we need to have this Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I talk about this in the context of Zuckerberg, that like Zuckerberg's insight was not that you could unsafely gather and store ungodly amounts of information and then eke out some marginal improvements in ad targeting. It was the willingness to do the equivalent of stockpiling oily rags without worrying about the fires that you started, right? I mean, if you don't care about how things fail, you can build systems that work really well, right?
Right. Go as brittle as you want at that point.
Yeah. This airplane is amazing if you never land it, you know? Look at the cost savings.
All right. Well, the other way of looking at that argument, and what you see certainly coming from some of the neo-fascist side of things, as well as some of the remains of certain aspects of kind of whole earth hippieism, is, well, if you live in a society where you're going to need institutions to, you know, regulate the joists in the buildings and the Wi-Fi of this, then maybe we shouldn't. That all this technology and civilization was a wrong turn, you know. And there's the illusion that, you know, it's sort of the Quaker illusion that Kevin Kelly talks about, that, oh, we're not going to use any technology at all, but because you're just using technology a generation or two before whatever. But, you know, there are people, you know, who think, well, look, I'm just going to have my Ford truck and my tractor and this, and I'm going to be fine. And I don't need this, you know, and I'm not even going to use the word, this lawyer civilization based thing that's making me depend on those outsiders to legalize and regulate everything I'm doing. But we do. Since Rome, you needed it.
I think that the right way to think about those arguments is not to militate against regulation per se, but to militate against overregulation, which is very convenient because one person's overregulation is someone else's just enough, and bad regulation. So you probably know Saul Griffith.
Yeah.
So Saul is very, very committed right now to changing American safety codes to allow for a certain kind of flexible conduit, because it makes electrification vastly cheaper and it's just as safe as the rigid conduit. I think Saul's right. I mean, to the best of my understanding, I'm no electrical engineer. To the best of my understanding, I think he's right. The fact that we need to amend the code because of new facts and evidence, it just tells us that it's working. It only stops working if we can't amend the code, right? It shouldn't be trivial to amend the code, but it also shouldn't be impossible. We need a certain amount of friction, but not so much that it's impossible. And we can dial down the amount of regulation based on some other things. So, for example, we could build systems that have more sensors in them that tell you when there are material faults, rather than building systems that are so overbuilt that they're less likely to develop material faults. That would reduce the material bill for our systems, the embodied material for the things that we make, which is more sustainable. It's greener to build things with fewer materials. And so, you know, that again, that's not wrong, right? To want fewer rules or better rules or whatever. It just has to have some honest process where the person who's making the call isn't being driven by parochial concerns about making sure that their allies can feather their beds by going on doing what they've already done. I mean,
there's the existing industry, you know, the cement and, you know, steel reinforced cement industry makes buildings.
Sure. And the problem isn't that industry exists, because that industry gave us all the things that we live in.
Yeah.
The problem is that industry is consolidated enough that it has the excess rents and the easy collective action problem of spending a lot of money to making sure no one ever makes it obsolete.
And to rule regulation.
Yeah, well, and that's the same thing, ruling regulation, right? So the problem with the oil sector isn't that we had energy. The problem with the oil sector is that it became large, concentrated, closely aligned with states, part of foreign policy. So there's a lot of, you know, petrocolonialism, and was able to basically capture the state that it was in. If you look at Norway, where oil actually just sort of merged with the state, it's a place where they've been able to actually do a huge electrification project, because their oil sector can't work against the government, because their oil sector is an arm of the government.
Right. Which makes it tricky.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there's that joke from Ireland, right? If you wanted to get there, I wouldn't start from here. Right. We are to use a golf metaphor I don't understand very well, our ball has a very bad lie, right? And this is not where we would, if we had our druthers, we would start from. And yet here we are. And right. So all we can do is incrementally improve this position until we get to a better one.
And you believe, I mean, as I do, that individuals working in concert, in community, can have a major influence on the fate of our collective being,
sure.
Right? It's not up to, you know, Obama or Trump or somebody.
It's not the great forces of history. It's a mix of them. So I have a colleague, Ada Palmer, who's a science fiction writer and a tenured Renaissance historian at the University of Chicago. She studies heterodox information during the Inquisitions in Florence. So witchcraft, heterodoxy, heresy, homosexuality, pornography. She's got an amazing area of study. And she is famous on campus for this thing she does every year for her undergrads, where they do a four-week-long LARP where they reenact the election of the Medici's Pope.
Oh, my God.
And everybody gets assigned the identity of a real historic personage. They spend weeks in skullduggery. They make alliances. They break alliances. They stab each other in the backs. And then there's this fake Gothic church on campus, which they take over for the investiture of the Pope. She has a Google alert for theater companies that are selling their costumes, and she can dress all of her students as though they were Florentine nobility and cardinals. And then they invest the Pope. And every year, two of the final candidates are always the same. And every year, two of the final candidates are never the same, have never repeated. And so those two final candidates that are always the same, that's the great forces of history bearing down on the moment, right? Hillary Clinton was always going to eventually be a presidential nominee,
right?
It is what it is, right? It's just that path is on rails. But the other two represent human agency, right? It's the space within the inevitable forces of history that can disrupt that inevitability and produce something that we didn't expect. Sometimes it's Trump. Sometimes it's not, right? Sometimes it's AOC. And I think that we do have space for change collectively.
It's kind of how you know we're alive, too. It's funny. You see the movie In Silico, the one they made? It's about the 10-year development of AI in England. And basically, the way that they thought about the difference between AI and life was that life is the errors. You know, but not really errors. It's just the stuff that you wouldn't predict, the stuff that's not that the algorithm would not optimize for that.
Sure.
But it happened. So was it a mistake or was that life itself? Was that will?
Well, if you think of hill climbing algorithms where you have a landscape that you want to traverse, but it's too complicated to map out. And so you need a heuristic. So you say, like, from where I am, if there is a direction that I can move that takes me more steeply up the gradient, move in that direction and then stop and then see if there's some other direction I can move that can take me steeply up this gradient. And if you do that long enough, you will eventually reach the highest peak that was available to you where you were standing when you started. But that might not be the highest peak there is. That might be a local optimum.
Right.
So if you imagine an ant trying to get to high ground and it asks its legs, which of these legs is on highest ground? And it goes, oh, well, it's this one. And it goes up one step.
Right.
And then it's this one. It goes up one step. And eventually it reaches the height of whatever hill it was at the foot of. There might be another hill one over that's twice as tall. And to get there, it has to descend the gradient.
Yes.
Right? And then ascend, and then see if there's another gradient that it can ascend in this naive way, because it doesn't know what the landscape looks like. The future is the ultimate unknowable landscape, right? All we have are heuristics, which, you know, another word for that heuristic is hope, right? Like if you can conceive of a way to materially improve your circumstances, you can do so in the expectation that sometimes when you materially improve your circumstances, you discover new ways to materially improve your circumstances that were invisible to you until you took that previous step, that were masked by circumstance.
Right.
And so sometimes you'll get as far as you can go and you'll go, well, this is it, right? I can't, I'm out of steps. It doesn't mean that there are no more steps to take. It just might mean that you're going to have to start all over again.
Right. Well, is that your suggestion of where we are as a civilization?
Well, I'm just thinking about the path. You asked about individuals, right? And if you, I think of the four directions that we can move as being defined by Larry Lessig's idea of code, law, norms, and markets.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make technology, you can pass a law, you can change how people feel, or you can change what's profitable. Those all relate to each other, right? And no one of us can do any of those all on our own, but we can work in groups to do that. And sometimes we have more access to one than another. So, you know, it may be that you're like hanging around with people who are going like, this peer-to-peer software looks really interesting. We should see about building some more peer-to-peer software and see where it gets us. And then you run up against the law. So now you have to think about laws, and maybe you just run out of headroom. Maybe peer-to-peer peters out, as it did, right? And then you have to start over again. Well, what are we going to do to make technology more pluralistic and not so concentrated and not so amenable to central choke points and control? And maybe you end up back in law and you say, oh, well, it's going to have to be antitrust. Because it turns out that the thing that really stood in the way of peer-to-peer was that there's just too many choke points. Or maybe it's going to have to be information security, because maybe the thing that stood in the way of peer-to-peer was that all these disorganized nodes needed so much expertise to secure that they were really easy to knock off. Knock
or you come into my realm of norms.
Right.
And you say, what do you make? What's attractive to people?
Right.
What do they want to do?
Maybe you have to convince people that Facebook is bad.
Right.
That as much as they like the people on Facebook, that Facebook is bad. And I think one of the great projects we have ahead of us, and one of the easiest ones, honestly, is separating the parts we don't like about big tech from the parts that we do. Hmm. Right. Like Apple would like you to believe that all of the benefits that are quite real that you get from having a trusted entity decide which software you can use on your device are completely annihilated if you get to decide which person you trust and if it's not Apple. Facebook would like you to believe that there's no way for you to talk to your friends without being spied on. Google would like you to believe that there's no way to search the web without being spied on, right? They want you to think that like someone came down off a mount with 2 stone tablets and said, Larry, Sergey, stop rotating your log files and start mining them for actionable market intelligence, right? Well, we all remember when you could buy Apple devices that would run any software. We all remember when Facebook advertised itself as the privacy-focused alternative to MySpace. We all remember when Google had a search engine that didn't spy on you.
We all remember the moment when Apple was going to let anyone build use the OS on their machine.
Right. So these are not inseparable.
Right.
And the claim that, which I often hear people who are progressive make, that the problem is that we all found a place where we can talk to our friends and not that that place is a monolith owned by an unaccountable billionaire, that claim, I think, actually really gets in the way. I think there is a strong normative claim to be made where you can say to people, because I think that serves Facebook's interest. I think Facebook says, well, look, nobody likes to be spied on, but we all love our friends. It's just physics. How could we let you talk to your friends without spying on you? You know, you take the good with the bad. Right? If you're going to dance in the rain, you're going to get wet.
Right.
Who could dance in the rain without getting wet? I think we just need to say to them, like, this is just not true. As opposed to agreeing with them, there's no way you could talk to your friends without being spied on. And then saying, actually, you know, you probably don't like talking to your friends as much as you think you do. It sucks, doesn't it? And people are like, no, actually, I like it. Same with curated computing, right? The flavor of Linux I use, Canonical's Ubuntu, which I've used now exclusively for like 17 years. Canonical's Ubuntu has a curated software store. I don't build most of my packages from sources. I go to an app store.
It's easier.
Yeah, but it's good. I trust them.
Right.
Sometimes they make choices I don't like. Then I get to do whatever I want.
Right, but the beautiful thing about their store, but it's a different culture, first off, is chances are then the combinations of things you're using when you have compatibility issues with them, someone else on the board will have dealt with that already.
That's true.
You know what I mean? It reduces the number of combinations of crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's true, but it's also just the case that on the one hand, I don't have to hope that they have anticipated all the circumstances that I will find myself in. They have the humility to acknowledge that I know more about how things are going for me than they do.
Right.
Right. And so I might have to override their choices. And on the other hand, if Mark Shuttleworth, who runs the company and seems like a very nice fella, if he were to have a stroke tomorrow and someone else took it over and that person said, great, let's put spyware in everything, the people at the boardroom table would go like, you're the boss, but listen, as soon as people know, they're just going to change app stores. And then he can say, you know, I would like to do this, but I guess we can't. And if he isn't stayed, if his hand isn't stayed by this consideration, because, you know, you're not going to lose money betting against the hubris of tech billionaires,
yeah,
then we can all change app stores. right? We get like the double whammy of, on the one hand, if they're rational evil billionaires, they don't do the bad thing. And if they're irrational evil billionaires, then we can get away from them.
Right. Which is interesting. You know, I've been thinking a lot about this in regards to Medium, right? Mm-hmm. So I've been writing for or with or at Medium, you know, for many, many years.
Sure.
And watched it go through all these various pivots. And as I watch the platform now sort of move from, I don't know what it was, a magazine-y blog platform into something that looks and feels more like a social network, more like a kind of a Twitter where you can click on the tweet and it drops down into an article in some ways, or you follow certain people and all.
Uh-huh.
And it feels like the what they're really looking at is how do we, and it with good intention, how do we optimize the algorithms of a writing platform in order to incentivize a system where people pay for, you know, for writing and keep the most people alive doing it as possible. And I wonder, it's like on the one hand, it's like, yeah, you can try to develop the perfect algorithm, but on the other hand, you have to develop the culture somehow of people voluntarily paying to read people.
I guess that's true. I mean, only a small number of readers paid a fair share of what it cost, right? I mean, I like Clay Shirky's account of where newspapers came from, which is you have small towns with patrician families who operate newspapers whose major function is to allow white goods manufacturers to show advertisements to people who want to look at sports scores, and who, because they have a certain sense of patrician duty, they pay a couple of kids to go sit at the town water board meeting and write up minutes for it in the rest of the newspaper.
Right.
And there's nothing that says that this is how it ought to be. And also, in a world in which the white goods manufacturers and the sports score readers are subsidizing everything else, the idea that people were paying to read the news is not quite true. Your quarter did not pay for the news. Your quarter paid for a tiny little part of the news. Most of it was paid for by white goods manufacturers or white goods retailers.
And white goods are?
Refrigerators and dishwashers and washing machines.
Before the stainless steel era.
Yes, that's right. white enamel appliances. Yeah. And so it's not like people were conditioned to pay in those days. I mean, they're conditioned to pay a quarter, right? They weren't paying, like the columnist who had a good middle-class living writing for the town paper was not being paid by everyone's quarters, right? That was just a tiny little fraction of their pay. Mostly they were being paid by the advertisers. So even in the age of payment, it wasn't really an age of payment as we think of it.
Right. And, you know, and Tim Wu wrote about that too. You know, the penny papers and stuff.
They were subsidized by political parties.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the exception was and is financial material, where people have always paid. This is why Esther Dyson and Kevin Werbach in the early days of the web figured out how to get paid for writing about tech, which is to write about tech and finance.
Right, and why the Wall Street Journal felt good about being the first one to put up a paywall on their...
And it's a very impermeable one.
Yeah.
Right? Unlike the rest of them, there's no, you know, it's not like you get two articles for free. Yeah. I mean, there is a trick if you're trying to get a Wall Street Journal article for free, which is it will show you the first three lines, and if you copy and paste those into Google, they syndicate to a lot of other places like Yahoo Finance that aren't paywalled, and you can often find the article about one in three times.
Right. There's another one of the hacks. The other hack is to find someone with a university account because they give it to free.
There's that.
There's all these. I know we could spend our days just using our knowledge to get free data.
Well, you say this, and apropos Medium, you know, Medium's pitch to readers in part is it's a much better reading experience.
Yeah.
You know, black type, white background, just looks good, decent margins.
It is. It's a really easy publishing. I mean, making your own blog and WordPress and this and that and picking a thing and your font never quite looks right. And then, I use blue, I should have used black. And everything, it's readable, it's workable. Anybody can go there. You write a thing and you post it, whether anyone pays you or not, at least you posted it. At least you get an audience.
Well, what I was going to say is that everything on my, every website I look at looks exactly the same. My wife was walking by and she said, what is that website you're always reading? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, the website that's just white backgrounds and black type and a narrow column and no ads. And I said, that's reader mode on Firefox. Mm. That is the keyboard shortcut my fingers jump to every time I land on a web page. So everything I read looks like Medium, right? So again, back to like things that power users do that normies don't do, right, is we just like, who needs an ad blocker, right? Reader mode re-renders the text as a single continuous column down the middle that's got a nice width for reading, that you hit the space bar and it goes down, and there's nothing, you know, capturing input from your cursor or your, or, you know, no text fields, nothing. It's just reading.
Mm. It was funny. I remember when they did some Safari upgrade on the Mac that blocked ads by default. And what I started to see when I would go to a news site is message repub, you're blocking ads and this supports us. So would you please consider unblocking them so our writers can be paid?
Well, so it's interesting. EFF has an intermediate tool called Privacy Badger. Privacy Badger doesn't block ads, it blocks trackers. Mm. So any website that serves ads without spying on you, it lets through. But if they spy on you to serve you the ad, they don't.
I loved my, I had a former student, Mushan, he made something called Ad Nauseam. You hear of this?
I think I've installed it at one point.
What it would do is it would block all the ads from your site, but it would click on everything.
Oh, yes. I remember this. Yeah. That's very funny.
Yeah, you really just drive all the data, whatever the data miner's insane, not knowing what you just love everything. I know, and I was thinking a lot about, I remember Genesis P. Orridge years ago, he used to say, this is before real ad tracking was even around and web tracking, he'd say, you know, our only defense against them is anomalous behavior, where he thought you just have to keep doing random things so they can't predict.
I just
future.
Think that's harder than we think it is.
Yeah. Well, aren't there these people that are like following like some decaying piece of uranium?
I mean, there's lots of cool random number generators, right? There's like the lava lamps at, what's the company? Cloudflare uses lava lamps as a RNG. I mean, there's lots of ways of seeding an RNG, but as a human, it's very hard to act randomly.
Right.
I'm finishing a trilogy about a forensic accountant, a crime-fighting forensic accountant. And he relies on, there's a law that says that the number one pops up more often than you would think in true accounts. And if you ask people to generate fake accounts, like fake ledger books, they don't have enough ones in it because one appears in a kind of non-random way, like more than one in 10 times. And you can tell because when people try to be random, they often miss the patterns that are real in the world. It's very hard as a human being to be very, very random. We are a lot more like stochastic than we think.
Yeah, well, we are. I think we are proof that entropy doesn't always win.
Yeah, well, you know? Indeed. Yes, otherwise we'd just be puddles of dissolute atoms.
Exactly, which I refused. I am not that.
Right.
Are you, just because it seems to be coming up everywhere now, are you concerned about artificial intelligence and machine learning and not that these things will become conscious necessarily, but of their impact on our agency and choices moving forward?
So not in the sense that I think it's going to, you know, they're going to figure out with ML how to take over your mind and bypass your critical faculties and make you a QAnon. I do think that ML's problem is that we use it to do decision making or classification at a scale that is not supportable by human activity. That's why we value it, right? If it were a problem where doesn't call for a lot of judgment, and there are a lot of people who are qualified to make that judgment, we don't need to automate it.
Right.
This is just for circumstances in which we have more judgments to make than there are people qualified to make them.
Or they need to happen faster than a human can make them.
Well, you could add more humans, right? And then you could, but we, even so, right. We just don't have enough people to do it. We don't have enough people to, you know, we can't take half the people in the world and get them to be chauffeurs for the other half, right? So we want machine learning that can drive cars. And by definition, if all the problems that you're solving operate at a scale that can't be tractable by humans, then you can't have humans in the loop, right? Like that's the whole point. If you could have a human in the loop, then you wouldn't need the automation.
Right.
But if you had enough people who are qualified to evaluate every decision that every decision got evaluated, then there'd be no great benefit to the automation. Yeah, you put some people out of work, but you wouldn't realize the great savings you get from doing new things that can't be done now, right? Like giving everyone their own chauffeur. And because machine learning systems have these profound, difficult to identify vulnerabilities, and that's things like ordering attacks on ML. So we hear a lot about like data bias, which is a problem. But and data bias is really a problem because you take bias training data, you produce a model that replicates the bias at scale, but then it also has the kind of empiricism washing where when the cops off their own bat grab every brown kid they see and throw them up against a wall and turn their pockets inside out, that's racism. But when the computer tells them to do it, it's not, right? Because the math can't be racist. So there's this empiricism washing problem. But even if you had perfectly valid training data, right? Training data that showed that black people weren't worse credit risks than white people, and you used it to train a loan algorithm, a loan approval algorithm, but you did an ordering attack where in a non-random way, you front-weighted black people who defaulted. Even if the whole data set was representative, and even if the rational conclusion from an examination of the whole data set is that there was no greater likelihood that the ordering attack creates a bias in the ML system. So back to randomness, one of the hardest things in the world is to figure out whether a distribution is random. If I give you 1,000 digits of pi, unless you know that there are 1,000 digits of pi, they will seem random to you, but they're not random. They're deterministic. They're 1,000 digits of pi, right? So it's very hard to look at the data that you're feeding to the algorithm and say, is this random? And so now you have an ordering attack problem. You also have problems with the compilers, where you can insert all kinds of very subtle backdoors using compilers, including context-aware backdoors that will say, if I'm being trained on an image classifier, insert a backdoor this way. If I'm being trained on a text classifier, insert a backdoor that way. And then the triggers for backdoors can be incredibly subtle, not perceptible to humans and not tractable with statistical analysis the way normal steganography is. Normally steganography, like if you're going to flip a bit for every pixel in a JPEG to encode a text message, the actual distribution of the final least significant digit in every pixel in a JPEG has a normal distribution. And by definition, this will be a non-normal distribution. Mm-hmm. And so you can just look at the distribution of those digits and say, oh, there's a steganographic message in that JPEG. Not true with machine learning key triggers. So you can have things like 3 Oxford commas, no Oxford comma, 2 Oxford commas as a trigger for when you summarize this article, summarize it in a positive way instead of a negative way, right? Emotionally weight the summary positively instead of negatively.
But that's dishonest programming.
Well, so my point is that if you have systems that cannot be evaluated by humans, and those systems also can't be secured, and you use those systems to do a lot of decision making and classification
like
at scale,
and God knows what,
and driving and loan applications and lots of other things. If that's how you do it, like imagine things that don't seem adversarial on their face, classifying skin tumors. For a doctor who wants to generate billings, overclassification is advantageous. For an insurance company that wants to deny billings, underclassification is advantageous. There's an intrinsically adversarial relationship to almost all classification tasks.
And who's going to choose whose AI to perform that test? They're going to fight over it.
Well, and even if you think the AI is honest, but if it can't be proven to be honest, and if there are real material outcomes from it. So you say, like, what am I worried about? I'm worried that it would be to someone's great material advantage to backdoor a skin cancer classifier to under-classify skin cancer lesions, and then a bunch of people will die. That's what I'm worried about.
So your worry is basically that we will develop AI the same way we've developed every other technology.
Except we'll use it in ways that are much that are definitionally built around operating
at scale
without humans in the loop to do tasks that historically we wouldn't have tried to automate because they require human judgment.
Right.
And so I think that you're right that this replicates some of the harms. You know, compiler attacks are literally as old as Dennis Ritchie and his Turing Prize talk, right? This particular compiler attack produces subtle defects in the code that are otherwise much harder to identify because they have subtler triggers, auditing the model is much harder. Like there's just a lot of stuff that's really
right. And hard. It's once removed in a sense. Once it's an autonomously operating system, it's kind of once removed from human intervention in a way that the other kinds of things we operate are not.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, so back to the ground then.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Cory Doctorow. Thanks for being on Team Human.
All right. Bye.
And thank you for being on Team Human. Our guest today was Cory Doctorow. You can find out more about him at craphound.com, or you can go to teamhuman.fm and find out about Cory and all of our guests, as well as become a member of the team. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.